Today's Teisho is on case 71 in the Hikigan Roku. Case 71 is entitled Goho's Shut Up. Main subject, Hyakujo said to Goho, "With your mouth and lips closed, how would you say it?" Goho said, "Osho, shut up." Hyakujo said, "In the distant land where no one stirs, I shall shade my eyes with my hand and watch for you." Secho's verse, "Osho, shut up." Upon the dragon's line, he plans his counterattack. Let's think of General Lee, who shot the eagle in the distant sky. Today is day three of our spring sesshin, and the other day I said it couldn't get any better than this, but it's better. You know, today I was sitting here, we had a beautiful sit this morning. Everybody was so still. People were sitting so well, and it was really amazing. We have a very challenging morning schedule. I don't know anybody else. I've never trained in any place where people get up and do an hour and a half of uninterrupted meditation in the morning. But it's really extraordinary, wouldn't you say? You know, we recite our sutras, we recite the sutras, and then we sit down and we don't move for an hour and a half, and we focus on our koans, and the world comes alive around us. And it's just, I think, the most extraordinary thing. Sometimes I get up in the morning and I'm coming down to sit, and the darkness feels so protecting. It's like something is waiting there for me. I don't think that's an illusion. There's like a deep connectedness to things, and I think it's especially open to it in the morning. That beautiful sense of connectedness. You know, sometimes we feel it naturally. That sense of being at oneness. Right? You just feel this deep sense of oneness. Maybe when you're hiking or doing a job you enjoy, something you've done many times, you know. My father-in-law used to make furniture. He was a design engineer, and he used to make the most beautiful furniture. He'd make it himself. And he had quite an elaborate shop. And I would go in there sometime when we were staying with him at one point, my wife and I. And I would go into his shop, and he was just he was just quietly working and seemed very happy. I think he had that deep sense of connectedness, just, you know, putting together a chair, he would carve designs in wood, with these beautiful wood chisels. I think just chiseling the wood, watching the chips fly, these long curls of wood would be very connecting for him. You know. And for us this morning, it's watching the breath. And the birds are just a riot, right? They're just amazing. When we were going to the bathroom after the morning sit, there was a woodpecker in the tree beside this building, and he or she was absolutely insane, you know, just cackling and making loud chucking noises. And it's just beautiful. And as I was sitting this morning, I looked outside, and the petals of the locust tree flowers are falling off like snow falling onto the cars. And I just thought, this is earthly perfection. where people get up, we're doing zazen together, and I think it's really quite remarkable. I think it's really rare when all the conditions in the world line up in this way so that people can cultivate body, mind, and heart in really optimum circumstances. You know, this is about as perfect as it could get. It's really wonderful. And, you know, today was just extraordinary. It's relatively, except in the dormitory, it's relatively low humidity. That seems to be, all the humidity in the state of New Jersey seems to be in that building. I don't know why, but it's actually a condensation machine. But nevertheless, except for that, you know, it's actually relatively dry, comfortable. It's sunny, it's not too hot, not too cold, perfect. But, you know, our practice would not be very deep if we only practiced under those conditions, you know. And our view of life would not be very complete if we only saw this kind of a, you know, this is our image of life. This day is our image of life. And of course we know that life is not always like this, right? I mean, it's not always like this. It's not always peaceful, for example. You know, there is a world out there of, this is like a special case, in my opinion. This is a special case because it's simplified. And it's an ideal situation. You know, in some ways, I think that this is like the best, I think this is the best way to live. I really do. I think we've simplified our environment. We've put meditation right at the center of our lives. Pretty much everybody here agrees that enlightenment would be a good thing, you know. And we're all here in pursuit of that goal. So we all agree, you know, fundamentally, and we even agree about how to pursue it, pretty much, right? Nobody is going to say, why are we doing zazen? I just don't understand, you know. You know, that's not, that person has already left the building. So we all agree about what the goal is, we agree about the method, you know. There might be some minor problems, you know, but basically we're all in agreement. And this is like a special world. And in fact, you know, I think monasteries are like this too. This is like you're spending 5 days in a Zen monastery. And monasteries are like designed to produce enlightenment, and they very regularly do. You know, actually, they're pretty effective at that. That doesn't mean that everybody in a monastery is enlightened or that everybody in a monastery gets along, but the opportunities for conflict are very limited by the nature of the enterprise, right? If you don't want to do a lot of zazen, you wouldn't go to a Zen temple. So the people who live in Zen temples tend to be people who like to do zazen or like to believe Nyenfo, reciting the Buddha's name, is a good activity, and they're all on the same wavelength. So actually, you know, the structure of our practice here is designed to keep, at a minimum, certain kinds of tensions and conflicts. And it's perfect for rapid enlightenment, right? And everybody's making fantastic progress. I mean, everybody's just, at this session, I'm so impressed by the quality of the sitting and the wholeheartedness of the practice. So it's a machine for enlightenment that's well oiled, and it's working very smoothly. We have good management in the Zendo. Kitchen is beautifully run, you know. Food is always like five-star hotel food, you know. It's really good. Even though we say, I will eat this food solely for the purpose of keeping my body in good health, it's also good that it's so delicious. You know? We don't say that, but you know, we recite the sutras, but it's a plus. Right? So everything here is designed to help us wake up, and it's also designed to minimize disagreements and conflicts. But the world is really not like that all the time. And I'm a huge bird fan. Right? I'm just a huge bird fan. My wife at one time was a birder. I don't know if you've heard that word, but birders are people who really study birds. And every year the Audubon Society does a bird count. And you're supposed to go to key places and keep records of how many birds you see. So people will go down to Cape May, for example, and just sit with binoculars for a week, or a couple days anyway. And they'll record, scarlet thrush, red-winged blackbird, I saw 10. And then they get together and they all compile statistics on how many of these birds they saw. And the Audubon Society sends them off to a bunch of scientists to see if the populations are going up or down and so on. So my wife actually used to do that. She was a big birder, and I got interested in birds. And I love birds. I don't know all the birds and their different sounds, but like you, this morning I was listening, I was rapt listening to the sounds of the birds. And it all fits so harmoniously into our beautiful practice. This morning I was in deep samadhi. I really felt like I was in heaven, and I'm not boasting. If you practice Zen long enough, that's how it'll be. That deep sense of oneness is quite persistent. And when you, I wouldn't have done this for 35 years if this didn't really feel good. And it really feels wonderful. And today was no exception. And I just had this wonderful sense of connectedness and harmony, which wasn't an illusion. It's really true. But it's complicated when we move beyond the circle of our practice here. So it's interesting that when birds are singing, they're not necessarily saying, "I love you," When birds are singing, they're not necessarily saying, "Spring is here, tra-la, tra-la." Right? They're not. It'd be nice, that if when you were a little kid, you might have sung a song like that, The little birdie sings, "Spring is here, tra-la, tra-la." Maybe they don't. Maybe it's rap music now. I hope not. I hope to God not. But when we were in school, we sang, empty little songs like that. The little robin sings, but actually the robin is probably saying something like, "Don't come over here, stay out of my turf. This is mine, 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 mine." Really, really. That's what that woodpecker was. Woodpecker was going, "It's mine, all mine, mine, right? Don't come over here, this is mine." So it's a more complicated picture, right? And the world is a complicated place. The natural world, too, is a complicated place. Because that harmony is not an illusion. It's not an illusion. But our experience of harmony can be challenged when certain things happen. Many, many years ago, my wife and I used to jog around Green Lake Park in Seattle, which is a big, beautiful lake in Seattle. And after work, Barbara and I and John Sunston and his wife Joan, my Zen buddy, would get together, and if we didn't have Zen that night, we would go for a jog around Green Lake. And we would jog around Green Lake, and then we'd sit and look at the water and look at the birds. And I remember we were all sitting looking at this little sparrow down on the ground. And about 4 feet from him was a crow. And I was actually thinking, isn't that wonderful? The crow and the sparrow, tra-la, tra-la. And the crow leaned over and grabbed the sparrow and ate him. It was like, "Oh my God! My crow just killed our little sparrow." wait a minute, what happened to my harmony, my beautiful harmony? It's a challenge, right? I mean, that kind of thing is, that's a moment when our confidence or that sense of connectedness to life can be shattered or challenged. You know, that's a moment when we have to do some work either on the cushion or off the cushion, because it seems to fly in the face of our confidence in the universe being a harmonious, unified place. It requires it's a challenge, right? I don't know if you've ever seen herons, but herons are beautiful birds. In the back of my house, along with my neighbors, Fidel and Keith, we had two very nice neighbors, Fidel and Keith, and they wanted to put in a fish pond in their backyard. And they got Barbara and me involved in building the fish pond, and it has a little stream that runs from one pond to the other in a hidden pipe. So from their pond it runs down into our pond, and then our pond has a little hidden pipe, and it goes back out, goes back around, and comes up and goes down this little waterfall. So there's a little waterfall that goes into their pond, and then it runs down a little stream, and it goes into our pond. And the water just circulates like that. And it's all run by a hidden electric engine, a little pump. And one day, we got the pond going, and it's quite lovely. We went and bought some koi, beautiful carp from Japan, and some goldfish, some big goldfish. And for about one summer, it was just majestic. I would come back down to the backyard and sit down, and you can hear the water, it was just beautiful. I'd look at the, there was a carp in Fidel and Keith's pond that was a gold and black splotches. Really, carp are quite wonderful animals, you know. Carp are really quite intelligent. Actually, it turns out fish, too, are quite smart. So, there's a place that sells carp on Route 22, and the carp in there are giant carp. They're like 2 feet, and they come up to you. When they see you, they think you're going to give them some food, but they come up and they look you right in the eyes, and they're quite intelligent, you know. And they have big lips, and I just want to lean down and give them a big kiss. You know, they're so beautiful. And they're very friendly, and they actually recognize you, you know. Anyway, we had a carp whose name was Big Bertha. Big Bertha was quite beautiful, and we'd sit and look at Big Bertha. So, I like birds, and I like herons. If you ever see herons, they're very mysterious, and they're very beautiful. You know, sometimes you'll be walking along the water, and you'll look, and there's a big bird, and it has a brooding look and a long beak. It looks very wise and old. And anyway, one day I was getting up and I looked out the back window and there was a heron there. I thought, a heron, how lovely. And then it leaned into the pond and it grabbed Big Bertha, right? And it was pounding Big Bertha on the ground. Now, I felt like, stop, you know, this is so wrong, you know. And then I realized that probably it was already over for Big Bertha, you know. The heron sort of cleaned the pond out, you know. So now we have a plastic heron that we put up, you know. And we actually net the pond during the fall so that the herons won't come down and clean us out. That's another moment where, you know, basically we... we have this image of the universe. The universe is a oneness, but it's not the kind of oneness we might think. You know, it's It's not a oneness where crows are happy to see sparrows and sparrows are happy to see crows. Crows eat sparrows. And the heron didn't come down to see the carp. It came down to eat the carp. You know. So this is like nature. This is the real natural world. And if we don't have a realistic image of the world, we have to sort of like repress certain. You know, we can't respond in a healthy and lively way. It's spontaneous. We don't trust ourselves. If our image of the world is not correct, if our image of the world is incorrect, we become fearful and we don't want to see things. So here, a good example of this is many years ago, my wife and I used to be meat eaters. We had a good friend whose name was Muhammad, and he was my Arabic teacher, and Muhammad introduced us to butchering meat. And we used to split the cost of a sheep. And Muhammad was from North Africa, and we'd go out into Washington State and buy a sheep, and usually on a farm, and we'd slaughter the sheep. And then we'd take this animal, and one minute it was an animal, and by about an hour and a half later, it was different cuts of meat. It was chops and I did that a couple times, and we saved a lot of money, and we had a freezer full of meat. But then one day I went out to this place where this woman sold us her sheep, and it was so clear that she had identified with the sheep, and she really loved that sheep. And when we put the sheep in the car and drove away in the truck, the sheep was looking at her going, "Mom, Mom." I know. So we took the sheep out and we slit its throat and etc. And that was the last time I ever ate meat in my life. I just decided I don't want to eat meat anymore. And, so I've made it like a conscious decision. I don't want that to be the price that I pay for my nutrition. You know. The interesting thing is that, you know, some people who are very moral people do eat meat, you know, so I'm not criticizing. It's like my personal decision. I'm not saying you can't be a good person and not eat meat, but it's a morally complicated issue, you know. Now, here's the thing. I'm not criticizing my wife, but my wife is a meat eater, you know, and she loves animals. She loves animals, but she eats meat. And she will, if a cat has a, like the other day, one of our cats caught a chipmunk. I don't know if you know what chipmunks are, but they're the cutest animal on earth. You know? They're like tiny little squirrels. Like if you ever saw Chip and Dale on the Disney Channel, they're incredibly cute. They're just adorable. And our cat, Minu, Bubbles, I came out one day and Minu was sitting in the grass looking very evil. really, I thought, that is a really evil look. And she's looking very, and she actually goes, and I looked and there was a chipmunk in her mouth. And I, "Bubbles, put that down," you know. And Barbara came out, "Oh, Bubbles, you bad cat," you know. And so we let the chipmunk go. And then Bubbles was looking everywhere for it, you know. So Barbara recognized the distress of the chipmunk, but she, you know, nevertheless, you know, she'll have a turkey burger, you know. And again, that's her choice, you know, it's her. But, you know, sometimes when we're watching TV, it'll be one of these nature shows, and it'll show the cheetah going after the wildebeest or something. And it's like the cheetah starts chasing the wildebeest, and then it grabs the wildebeest, and Barbara always goes, "Ah, I can't look," you know. Now, there's something wrong with that, right? Because, you know, and I can't look. When is the turkey burger done? So that's not, I think there's a conflict there. Something hasn't been worked through. And I can't claim to have all the answers, but we need to confront things that are, that stand in the way of the wholeness of our world. You know, that's the challenge in Zen. when you sit on the cushion and you practice Zazen for 3 days, sometimes you have a deep experience of the oneness of things. But then, you know, the challenge is when you're not on the cushion and you're out in the world and you're encountering people who don't share the same values, they don't have the same goals. And one key aspect of that is this element of aggression. You know, and aggression is part of nature. You know, the lion eats the little, you know, whatever, and the cat eats the chipmunk. And there's no world, you know, there are actually people who try to give their dogs vegetarian food. And that's okay, but you're not going to reform them. You know what I mean? Dogs like meat, you know. So, you know, basically it's a dog's nature to eat meat. It is. It's a dog's nature to eat meat. So, you know, what I was getting at yesterday, I think I shocked some people yesterday. But at least it was interesting, right? It's a better taisho than just snoozing through, you know. But this element of, this aspect of aggression and violence in the world and how we respond to it is a big question mark. I don't have the answer. But I do think we have to, it's something we have to explore, and it often becomes an issue in Zen practice in ways that people don't always appreciate. So, you know, people can be seriously affected by aggression and violence in their lives, you know. And it's not necessarily something we want to look at, and it's not necessarily something we want to explore, but it's a real factor. And I do think people have, I think especially in the Buddhist world, we have misconceptions about how to deal with aggression and violence. And this is my personal feeling. You know, I think that nonviolence is the goal, is a very good goal, you know. The Buddha categorically refused to allow people to hit back. So there's a story, actually, about a monk who was walking down a street. And Buddhists weren't popular in India at one time, around the time of the Buddha. And somebody, just some monks were going down the street, and somebody leaned over and hit a monk. And the monk hit the person back, and the Buddha said, "Look, you've really failed. You know, you can't continue to be a member of this order if you respond in that way. You're out." So the Buddha was very strict about nonviolence, but. You know, and I think we all take a cue from the Buddha. We want to be kind and compassionate and nonviolent people, and that would be good. We should be. But how to get to that place is a very complicated issue. And I think it's very important to appreciate the way violence leaves traces in our lives. And how it can close our world down, and how we need to confront sometimes the injuries that have been done to us in order to open our world up again. You know, I'm not trying to get your sympathy, but it's an interesting story. You know, when my mother was 19, something like that, my mother was like an avid reader, and she wanted to be a lawyer, and her father wouldn't send her to law school because women didn't get educated in those days. So my mother was kind of a remarkable person. She worked as a court reporter. She worked as a legal, she taught herself, you know, she went to become a legal stenographer. She learned shorthand. She was an excellent legal stenographer. And she eventually became a court reporter, which is a respected sort of job in the legal system. And so she started keeping records of court trials, meticulous records, and then later she was the county court reporter. So she would actually be responsible for keeping all the records for the county court. And my mother was a resourceful and interesting person in many ways. She, after her divorce, she ran an apartment complex. She got a real estate license, and she did many interesting things. You know, when my mother was 17 years old, or 18 years old, she was dying to see the American West. And she and another friend hitchhiked across the United States. That's unheard of, in the middle of the Great Depression. And they took some trains too, but they hitchhiked and they took trains. And I guess Casper, Wyoming, my mother was, you know, sexually assaulted. And she came, you know, apparently some college guys were out on a lark, and they found these two girls and they assaulted them. And my mother called my grandfather and said, you know, this is what's happened to me. And my grandfather, who was a French-Canadian man, very nice man, drove across the country and picked her up and brought her home. You know, when she was descending into senility, she had fantasies that she was being pursued by college boys. Yeah. And, you know, that, in other words, 60 years later, this is still there, you know. So I'm not trying to get your sympathy or to, you know, but these things matter. Right? So we all suffer injuries as we're growing up. They don't have to be of that kind. But, you know, parents are not always loving and kind to us. You know, sometimes we have been the victims of real violence. You know, when I was in the area where I was growing up, it was very common for parents to beat their children with belts. That was considered a good parental practice. And that's not healthy for a little child to be whipped with a belt. And it has an effect. Sometimes parents are extremely, don't use physical violence, but they use verbal violence and other kinds of violence. I was reading about a person who said, her father and mother used to say, you're trash, you know? So these things matter. And when we sit on the cushion, you know, and we're in the moment, everything is placid and calm. But sometimes, when we're out in the world and we're encountering violence, we are unable to respond to it creatively or constructively because of the way we have been treated, or the way we have been. We learn to respond as children, you know. So, if you're a child and your parents frighten you or do violence to you, you experience yourself as helpless, right? Helpless. And this is a very terrible feeling. You know, you're a little child and you don't have the power to strike back and defend yourself. And this can have the effect of making you feel powerless, hopeless, et cetera, et cetera. And then you grow up, you know. You're 6'3", you're 200 pounds, but in your mind, you're still like that little kid who doesn't have the power to defend herself or defend himself. And this can affect the way we interact with the world. You know, yesterday, when I was talking about this, you know, when we're done an injury, when we're on the receiving end of aggression, it's very common for certain people to feel powerless in the face of that aggression, and also to feel that it's wrong or it's wrong for them to be angry. In response. You know, it's often the case that people who have been victims of abuse of some kind in childhood grow up blaming themselves. You know, I have a friend of mine who is a psychiatrist. He's a some of you. He's a psychotherapist, and he's a good friend of mine. And he was telling me about studies of people's behavior. It's called cutting. I don't know if you know about this behavior, but some people actually go home and cut their arms. You know, this is very common in women. You know, very common in women, where they, you know, if somebody, they go to school and somebody insults them or makes them feel bad, they go home and they actually cut themselves. This is very common. You'd be surprised. And this behavior is, you know, basically the behavior of somebody who doesn't feel empowered to be angry. To be angry. And that anger is turned against the self. So instead of saying, you have hurt me, I say to myself, I'm a bad person. See, I'm the bad one here. And basically, if you feel anger, you say, oh, I'm not feeling any anger. I don't feel angry. And this is a big problem in particular for people who want to be Buddhists, who want to follow the Buddhist way, because sometimes you are responding to aggression in a way that is self-punishing. And so be wary of this. You know, this is what I was talking about yesterday when I was saying it's okay to say, shut up. It's okay. It's okay to get mad. It's okay to get mad. See, it's very necessary, as a matter of fact, for people to direct their aggression to have aggression, and to direct the aggression at somebody who's hurting them. This is psychologically very necessary as part of the process of dealing with aggression. So if you're imagining yourself as somebody who has transcended all aggression, I'm a Buddhist, I don't feel hate, this is very unhealthy. You know, I don't get angry. I don't allow myself to get angry. That's very unhealthy. It's, you know, and often that produces depression, and it produces other kinds of like psychological disorders, because the aggression is directed back against the self. See, if you're angry, it's your fault for being angry. It's your fault for being angry. See, but please don't allow yourself to think that way. You know, when you're meditating on the cushion, sometimes you may find yourself angry. You know, and you'll be surprised. If this hasn't happened to you, you have had an interesting life. But you may find on the cushion all of a sudden you think, holy crap, I'm really mad. Where is this anger coming from? See, now, that would be a good question to ask. Where is this anger coming from? What are the sources of this anger? And that's like a koan in itself. You want to explore the sources of your anger. What would be a big mistake is to say, this is anger, not good. See, anger's not good, very destructive. It's like, no, you have to understand the sources of your anger. And so there's a time, you know, yesterday I was talking about the fact that in Zen practice, in the Zen literature, there's all of this aggression. So, you know, basically, one teacher, you know, I said yesterday, Hakuin's teacher used to actually shove him out the window. So when that doesn't happen to us here, there's no window. But Dokusan would take place on the second floor of this hut. And Hakuin would go in to see his teacher, and his teacher would shove him right, push him right out of the window. And happened to many times. Yesterday in the koan, I looked at one person slaps, Rinzai slaps another person. And in this koan, a person, monk, is asked a question. He says, shut up! Shut up! And you might say, well, that's not enlightened behavior. You can't imagine going to a public talk where there's the Dalai Lama and somebody asks him a question and the Dalai Lama goes, shut up! Slap somebody's face, right? But that would be a Zen, that Zen masters would do that. You know. They might spend a night in jail. You know. And it's easy for us to see these as stories. You know, these are like the Three Stooges. These guys are like clowns and clowns. But this issue of aggression is very important, and it's quite a serious aspect of Zen practice, of liberating ourselves. And so discovering anger in yourself is not a crime. It's not a crime. It doesn't show you're a bad person or a bad Buddhist, and you shouldn't try to cover it up. And you shouldn't just try to walk by it. Understanding the sources of our anger is intelligent practice. Just like understanding the sources of our other illusions, yeah, greed, and so on. Understanding the sources of this is really important, and that means admitting that you have anger. Right, admitting and not being ashamed to have anger, and also, you know, there is such a thing as a time to be angry. There is a time to be angry. Anger. It's very important to understand this. When Gandhi practiced nonviolence in India, but he didn't sit down with the British and say, "Okay, you guys can stay." So, you know, you have your view, I have my view, let's compromise. You can continue to run India, and I'll live in my ashram. How's that? Everybody happy? You know, what Gandhi did was basically to, take India away from the British Empire and actually destroy the British Empire, ultimately. And it unleashed a lot of violence that Gandhi couldn't control. Because that's part of the natural way. So understanding violence and being able to deal with violence in yourself can't be achieved by pretending that you don't have anger, or pretending that, or feeling that all expressions of aggression are off the table, are unlawful. It's okay to say to somebody, "Fuck you." You know, that's okay sometime. And it's okay to be mad. You know, in Western tradition, forgiveness is very important, because people believe that if you commit a crime, you're going to go to hell. And your eternal soul depends very much on being forgiven for your crimes by God. See, so that's a very, you know, forgiveness is very important. But in Buddhism, I think it's a little different. You know, the real question is, how do we get to enlightenment? When I've been done an injury, the person I have to be most concerned about is not really the person who did me the injury. It's me. I have to be able to free myself from the karmic chains that have accompanied that injury. And if I can do that, I can help others. And if I can't do that, I can't help others. So it's a little different emphasis. When a person has suffered an injury, the real person, you know, who matters is the person who suffered the injury. Forgiving the aggressor is nice, but it's not the real issue for the person who's the victim of violence. The person who's the victim of violence is the victim. That person bears the scars and needs to be set free. So in some ways, the emphasis on forgiving is misplaced. Each of us has to work out our own enlightenment in our own way. The aggressor has to answer for his aggression in his own way. He has to work through that himself. And you really can't set him free. You know, forgiving him doesn't help him, actually. So the important thing is, the person who is the victim of violence has to be set free from the scars of that violence. And that means acknowledging that, you know, probably you have some anger in yourself and not pretending it doesn't exist, because if you do that, you will often direct that anger against yourself. And so sometimes anger, the expression of anger, can actually connect us more deeply to the world. Isn't that interesting? Sometimes the expression of anger can actually connect us more deeply to the world. And that's what this koan is all about. See, there is something isolating in telling somebody to shut up. You know? There's some, you know, when you say to somebody, shut up, you're pushing them away. You're saying, get out of my world, okay, in a certain way. But also in another way, you're also communicating something, right? You're actually also expressing yourself. You're communicating to that person something, which is, I have been hurt. You have done me an injury. Right? So it's not just one thing. It has this dimension of pushing the person away, but it's also a way of communicating. And if we are open about our anger, if we acknowledge our anger and we begin to understand the sources of our anger, I think it's possible for real healing to take place, and it's possible for us to stop directing that anger and that aggression against ourselves, which is very, very common. You know, because people grow up feeling unworthy or unloved, you know, when things go wrong, they instantly blame themselves. It's amazing, you know. I was talking about this yesterday, that something like 30% of college graduates can't get a job right now. And a huge number of those people are living with their parents because they simply can't afford to take care of themselves. And lots of those people feel personally responsible, like they failed, right? Even though actually the system has failed them. People are so ready to condemn themselves. This is a part of unhealthy mind. So, you know, some things happen to us and sometimes, I think, enlightened people, awake people, are able to understand that sometimes things are out of our control and I'm going to let myself off the hook, you know? If you do your best and you let yourself off the hook, there can be real joy in life, you know? And sometimes that means... Sometimes it's okay to say, shut up. You know, when you say to somebody, shut up, you're not, you're actually initiating a conversation. No, but you are, aren't you? I mean, it's a complex utterance, right? But you're initiating a conversation in a certain way. Yakujo said to Goho, with your mouth and lips closed, how would you say it? Have you ever felt like that, like you couldn't speak? I can't. There's something I have to say, but I can't speak. I can't speak. See, this is like so common, right? I can't, you know, if we have experienced if we had the wrong kind of upbringing, right, this sense of powerlessness, of voicelessness, unable to speak, unable to act, you know, is so powerful, right? Yakujo said to Goho, with your mouth and lips closed, how would you say it? You know, you can't open your mouth, you can't open your lips. Can you speak? And Goho says, shut up! Right? Okay, and Yakujo says, in the distant land where no one stirs, I shall shade my eyes with my hand and watch for you. Says, he says, now we're starting to connect. See, sort of saying, now we're starting to connect. Secho's verse, Osho means priest, you should shut up. Upon the dragon's line, he plans his counterattack. Let's think of General Lee, who shot the eagle in the distant sky. So, you know, shooting an eagle, it's bad, right? I myself try not to to even kill an ant, you know. But nevertheless, you know, aggression is part of life. I'll let you go. But, you know, I was reading when they built the Potala Palace in Tibet. When they built the Potala Palace in Tibet, the people who built it were so careful that they actually screened all the dirt that went in to make the adobe bricks. In other words, they took the dirt and they put it onto screens and sifted the dirt. All the dirt that built the Potala Palace, they sifted it to get all the worms out. So when they built the building, they wouldn't kill any worms. Isn't that interesting? It's almost insane, right? Very, they wanted this to be compassion central. But on the other hand, you know, when Tibet was attacked, people went out and defended themselves. You know, for many centuries, Tibet's neighbors used to attack from the east and wipe out whole monasteries. I remember reading a travel book where this guy came into a Tibetan monastery, and people from the east were from another religion. And they had chopped all the heads off of the monks and strung them like a garland across the gate. And the Tibetans sent, the Dalai Lama sent the army out and pushed these people back. And they killed people. You know, so aggression is part of life. You know, how we deal with it is a koan in itself. But we have to deal with it. And it's not helpful to pretend that we can live without aggression. That we, you know, there is a kind, you know, one more thing. If you go to Zen temples in China, Buddhist temples in China, there's always these fierce guardian figures outside the temple. And they're very fierce warriors. And they have a glaring look and they have rippling muscles like nobody's business. You know? And they're looking very fierce. And they're right outside the temple. And so the first thing you do when you go into a temple is you see these symbols of like anger on the way into the house where enlightenment is guarded. So, you know, aggression is part of life, and part of your liberation is coming to terms with these negative energies or these energies in yourself, which are actually protective energies too, right? I mean, the whole point of the statues is that aggression can kill, but it also sustains life. It also protects life, right? This is not exhausted as a subject today. But the important thing is to be on the guard for when you turn your aggression against yourself. This is quite common in the modern world. When you find yourself hating yourself, that's a very, very, that's a sign, right, that something like this has happened to you in your life. It's a sign that some kind of an injury has been done to you, and that basically your response is not healthy. Perceiving your anger and vocalizing it is really part of liberation.